This is the BioBalance Health Podcast, episode 21. I'm Dr. Kathy Maupin, founder and medical director of BioBalance Health. With me today is Brett Newcomb. He is a presenter and trainer and a marriage and family counselor. Today we're talking about orgasm, the functionality
and
just the facts about it.
Yeah.
Because no one talks about this. This is one of those things that no one talks to their doctor about because there's not time. It's a long discussion, or they don't want to go to a psychiatrist to talk about this because usually nothing's.
Well, they talk sometimes if they have defined issues, like if they have premature ejaculation issues or if they are anorgasmic and that concerns them. But generally, in the general population, there's not a lot of talk about orgasm. There's a lot of talk about sex, you know, sexual encounters, frequency, desire, what have you. But all of those conversations at some level involve the understanding of or the functionality of the orgasmic response, which can be different in men and women. And there's a lot of literature out there that breaks it down scientifically. But if you're not a scientist, it's kind of hard to read through that information and get the critical information or usable information, which is why sometimes they come to you or to me or someone like us to have those conversations. But we have to find a way to open the door to that conversation.
True.
So one of the ways potentially to open the door to a conversation about orgasm is to talk about the evolving understanding or the evolving definition of orgasm, what it actually is. Is it a physiological event? Is it a psychological event? Is it a sociological event? I mean, or how does it mix? What are the disparate elements that come together?
And why do we have them? I always want to know why. You know?
Yes, well, but that's the scientist in you.
I always want to know, what was the purpose of this? So we've
well,
done...
Well, it's kind of like the guy said about art. I don't know what's art, but I know what I like.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly... That's perfect for the description of this. The one of the books that we've used to... So we can cite something and not just our own experience, which is vast in the subject in terms of talking to our patients.
In terms of working with people that have these issues, not in terms of the amount
no,
of...
No. No.
Just checking.
No, that's... Don't do that to me. It's in talking to patients about their lives. And 25 years of that on my end and 30 years of that on your end has a lot of stories and a lot of history that we've learned from our patients.
A lot of pain. A lot of people that are suffering around these issues because they are not educated or informed, or they're culturally bound, or they're physically limited, and medicine has not had a solution for them until recently, and psychology really hasn't had a solution for them until recently.
And it's only been 5 years since American College asked OBGYNs to get a sexual history as part of their history.
That's incredible.
And so one of the things we ask is your sex life adequate? But most women aren't going to talk about that. And most doctors don't want them to, because doctors in general, MD, DOs, we aren't picked because we're social human beings.
Mm-hmm.
We're picked because we're smart. And if we're social human beings, that's a plus. But it's hard for most MDs and DOs to actually broach the subject. They were nerds. We were all nerds. We didn't have much of a sex life like everybody else because, you know, we had a really delayed adolescence, but we didn't take advantage of it.
Well, it's also difficult to have an open and honest conversation in those settings if the husband and wife are both there, or if both partners are there. At least initially. Some of this information you have to get individually. Then you bring them back together and talk about it.
And it takes multiple visits and everybody's busy.
Right.
So in any case, we have one of the sources, just in case you're interested, is a book called The Science of Orgasm. It's one of my favorite books just because I was waiting for this book to come out by somebody. Anyway, it's by Kamisarek, like Kama Sutra, only Kama Sarek, only it's Kamisaruk, and he's a PhD, and he and several other authors came together to describe the medical physiology, how it works, the history of it, and then things that cause problems in function and things, other medical things that interfere. But we're going to talk about those, but not necessarily all today.
And I would say that it is a book primarily for scientists, physicians, academicians.
Right. If you could read it, I just say, read this book and we'll stop talking.
Right.
But it's a book for, it's really a book for doctors
yeah.
to understand this. And I have to say, most doctors don't. I have to, when I was in the operating room, I used to operate and I used to always leave the cervix in because the cervix is one of the three orgasms comes from movement of the cervix. So when I did hysterectomies, I always left the cervix in unless there was cervical cancer. And I've been doing this forever. And I would always have a male doctor, usually a urologist or another surgeon, walk in and say, tell the residents why you leave the cervix in. And then they'd laugh mm-hmm. and walk out, or they'd laugh and listen because they didn't believe me.
Mm-hmm.
They thought it was ridiculous.
But this book talks about that research.
And I bought 12 copies and I sent them to every yes. surgeon who ever made fun of me in the operating room because this actually delineates the nervous system yeah. and it is, you have to leave the cervix in.
It's a feedback
in.
Loop.
Right. That's and absolutely correct.
To the brainstem. And without that there, then the full experience is not possible because they don't get the feedback that's required.
Well, I was watching Oprah in 2000 and I saw somebody who had lost her orgasms because of hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I never want to be that doctor.
Yeah.
Ever. Because this woman was furious. But it turns out that they had taken her cervix and they had not given her hormones back. That's two things.
Right.
However, that was her only type of orgasm. She didn't have one of the other two. She didn't have clitoral stimulation orgasms or G-spot orgasm. So that was it. And when the cervix was gone, it was gone. I just never wanted to be that doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the evolution of our understanding of orgasms. You know, most people know about the Kinsey research. There's a lot of jokes out there about it, although I don't know that very many people have actually read it. It's just been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm. I was in the 50s.
1953, Kinsey et al. Defined orgasm as the explosive discharge of neuromuscular tension at the peak of sexual response. And part of coming up with a definition is you're trying to hit a moving target. I mean, an orgasm is a moving target. It's mm-hmm. not a certifiably discriminate or discrete marker that you can check a box and say, well, that's done. So,
especially until you've had one. Before you've had one, it's really hard to tell if you've had one. Kind of, you know, most yeah. of the patients that come in to see me say, I never had one, and now I've had one. Now I know what they're all talking about.
Yes. Yeah, especially if they have a history of being anorgasmic.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they don't know. And they don't know how to, it's kind of like asking a blind person to describe the elephant, you know, what do you see? And you mm-hmm. get totally different answers.
And everyone has different experiences with orgasms too.
And then in 1966, Masters and Johnson here in St. Louis were famous for their research and the things that they developed. And they described orgasm as a brief episode of physical release from the vasocongestion and myotonic increment developed in response to sexual stimuli.
I'm a doctor and I don't even know what that
means.
No,
nobody does. I mean,
I went to the Master and Johnson week-long course back in mm-hmm. the 80s. It was awesome, but they didn't describe it that way.
Well, let me give you one more scientific definition. This is a Kothari and Patel. 1991, an explosive cerebrally encoded neuromuscular response at the peak of sexual arousal elicited by psychobiological stimuli, the pleasurable sensations of which are experienced in association with the dispensable pelvic physiological concomitants. Duh.
See, you know, that's really hard for even a wordsmith like you to take apart and understand. I think it's just so complicated in terms of personal experience and trying to describe it that everybody has a different definition. And, you know, interestingly enough, this is scary, but the American College of OBGYN, which is the ruler of OBGYN practice for the United States, up until about, I guess it was 10 years ago, maybe, or a little bit less, 8 to 10 years ago, we had a president of ACOG write in his editorial page of our journal that all sexual response by women was secondary to male stimulation. So he did not believe that women had a sexuality.
So they were sexually neutral?
They didn't have a sexuality without their spouse, supposedly. Okay. And he didn't even take into account lesbians, which mm-hmm. he should have. And he should have taken into response women who are never with a partner, but still masturbate and still have a sexual response. They're still sexual beings. They still have fantasies. They still mm-hmm. have all kinds of other sexuality in their lives, even if they don't have a partner. It was just ridiculous. It just showed how archaic our organization is in terms of that of sexual
and the literature counseling. Looks at that issue, and it talks about the fact that there are men and women who can achieve orgasm, or what they understand as orgasm, without sexual stimulation and without a partner. So they don't have to touch themselves. They don't have to use some device. They can fantasize and imagine and reach that point. That's more common in women than it is in men, but it can happen to both.
Well, that's the guy that's sitting at his desk with it, looking at, with his eyes far, far off. Yeah, well, anyway, I think probably the best definition of an orgasm would be a pleasurable emotional response, but it's also a physiologic response that involves blood flowing to your pelvis and a release of tension. And that's about all I could say would be universal for orgasms. And honestly, I'm not sure that we need to
break
define
it any further. No.
Because when you have one, you know it.
Well, and again, you talk about common wisdom or common knowledge, common issues around the topic of orgasm. And in my experience with men and women, couples coming into my office to talk about these issues, they ask questions about what's normal. You know, am I normal? Am I abnormal? What's normal in terms of size? What's normal in terms of frequency? What's normal in terms of firmness of the erection? What's normal in terms of the orgasm count? Are you multiply orgasmic? What if you don't have orgasm? And anecdotally, what I have said before is that it's my observation from talking to these individuals is that as a man matures, he becomes more available for intimacy and less orgasmically focused. Young men are all about the score, all about mm-hmm. the resolution, and they will brag about, you know, how many women they've had or how many times they've done it or how often they reload or whatever the marker may be.
Because they can,
yeah. But as they diminish in their ability to do that, they have to replace that with something else. And that's actually a beautiful opportunity, because when they do that, they start to pay more attention to their female partner and her responses and her needs and her desires than they do to their resolution experience. And so what happens then is there is an opportunity for increased intimacy and a different level of sexual satisfaction than maybe either of them have ever experienced before. So one of the strongest components of a healthy sexual life is paying attention to your partner, to the experience, getting your mind involved. Your mind is your most sexual organ, and not just because it releases the hormones and the neurotransmitters, but because the psychosocial byplay that comes from the fantasy, the conversation, from the attunement to the responsiveness of your partner.
Well, that would be ideal.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. And I deal with patients who are testosterone deprived. So generally with aging, my patients at BioBalance generally have lost their testosterone, and in general, they have lost their ability to have orgasms. They're not always forthcoming with that being their primary problem. I'm not a psychologist, so they don't want to tell me all their intimate details.
Right.
They often don't feel comfortable enough until they've seen me a couple times to tell me that they're having orgasmic problems. They'll tell me they're having trouble with their sex lives.
Well, yeah, and they're going to have corollary anxiety and depression issues, because a lot of men have defined themselves by their sexual prowess.
And women define themselves by their husbands often, not always, but mm-hmm. but by their partner. And if their partner's not happy.
And so if I am diminishing.
And if your wife is diminishing.
Exactly.
Then we got problems at home
yeah.
because nobody's happy. Women are more process and experiential, enjoying the experience,
right.
and men are more goal-oriented in general. And so as soon as the men are so upset about the goal that they aren't involved in the experience at all.
And the goal is often twofold. The goal is the wonderful erection I can have mm-hmm. and the orgasm. And if either or both of those.
And making your wife have an orgasm. Because
yes.
that's often what I hear.
Although a lot of men are less concerned about that than they are measuring their own functionality.
Yeah. That's true.
So one simple solution, according to the advertising media, is to take an ED drug. And they make those commercials look like everybody in town has this issue. But, you know, if you just take one of these little pills, then the trees bloom and the water spills.
That's why it's called advertising.
Yeah,
it's exactly. It's not a medical reality or a life reality.
Right. And so they try to get these drugs and not necessarily understand or evaluate or have an evaluation for a full-blown physical, because these drugs, the fascinating piece about it for me is these drugs evolved serendipitously from research on blood pressure medicine, because they work by controlling the blood flow and regulating the blood mm-hmm. flow and focusing
dilating the vessels
on
the pelvis.
Yeah. But guys with erectile dysfunction issues, that is often a marker of blood pressure problems. And so, you know, they're waiting to have a stroke or they're waiting to have a heart attack.
Or blood vessel problems. They have clogging of the arteries, basically.
Yeah.
And they can't get enough blood flow down there. But I want
to
talk about ED
in
another podcast, because we haven't completely exhausted this at all.
Sure.
This subject, in terms of I get asked a lot, what happens in an orgasm? I mean, exactly what's happening? And the fact is that stimulation, it's all about oxytocin and testosterone. If you don't have testosterone, generally, you're not making oxytocin.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that's male or female?
Male or female. And so generally, my patients, once they get testosterone, feel so much better because their oxytocin goes up.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about oxytocin a few weeks ago. It's the cuddle hormone. But it works directly on the brain to increase responsiveness to touch and stimulation. And then stimulation causes more oxytocin. So it's kind of a positive feedback system.
Mm-hmm.
And my patients, when they become intact again, we don't generally have to go through too much stuff like this unless there's some other problem. However, they asked me about this. And so you have to have testosterone in your brain and in your body,
mm-hmm.
and you have to have oxytocin from the testosterone, or when we get too old to have the testosterone cause oxytocin to go up, then we have to have that replaced as
right,
well.
Let me make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. The oxytocin that comes with the testosterone is a requirement for an orgasm, or is a benefit of an orgasm, or both?
Both.
Okay.
Both. It, the system goes, testosterone lays the groundwork in the brain for oxytocin to be produced in general, in people under 70 generally. And then when the patient is stimulated, they think about something, they start the ball rolling with, because of the testosterone being present, the oxytocin goes up, then touch and breast stimulation or any kind of stimulation to the body
mm-hmm.
is going to cause the oxytocin to increase. And then it's a positive feedback system. It increases dopamine. Dopamine then goes to the nerves that go to the pelvis, dilating vessels.
So would that
and
be one of the reasons?
Blood flow there.
Would that be one of the reasons that the literature says that as men age, they need more direct stimulation physically in order to get a good erection?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the oxytocin diminishment.
Right. But in general, as men age, they're talking about men without any testosterone support.
Right.
So they're talking about, oh, testosterone drops and then
oxytocin
these other
things drops. Happen. Right.
So they're talking really about, if you go back upstream, which is what I always like to do, what's the first thing that happened? The first thing that happened is testosterone dropped.
Yeah.
If we go back to that step, then we don't have to deal with all these other things
right. In
general, because we treat the testosterone.
Okay, that's helpful.
But because they want this, they go through this and they want the steps going on. Some, you know, it's a neurologic function that's stimulated by these hormones. So you have to have your hormones intact. You have to have your nerves intact. I mean, it's a young person's game, basically,
mm-hmm.
but we're going to live a long time. And it's such a pleasurable experience. We don't want to give that up as we get older. And I think that's a driving force for patients to come in and see me. One of the cool facts about this whole process is in the neurologic process, you can tell when your partner's having an orgasm. If you can't tell another way, you can tell by pupil dilation.
Right.
And so that's one of the neurologic things. It's kind of one of those little pearls.
You can tell if you're paying attention, which comes
right
back
to, you have to actually look at their eyes, which is not always possible, depending on. Anyway, having said that, the other thing to that I thought was very interesting, we've already talked about the different types of orgasms, but no one really talks about that. And everybody talks about clitoral orgasms. Yes, that's the most common. But the G-spot, my most frequent question on that is, where is it?
Right.
And so my answer is, it's about an inch behind the opening of the vagina on the top. I call it's the top part, the part that's that lies right under the bladder. The top part
that's
of the
vagina. Anterior vaginal wall.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, anterior is kind of a... That's what I was trying not to say. Anterior vaginal wall.
I was watching you.
About an inch in.
Yeah.
And it's and it feels a little bit like a lump of tissue, like a ridge. But it has a lot of neurons in it. Mm-hmm. And so that's the G-spot. And then, of course, most people know where the clitoris is. And most people know where the cervix is.
Yeah.
So, but those type of orgasms, you can have them all together depending on stimulation. You could actually stimulate all three. Some people get the G-spot through, can I say anal? Anal.
Sure.
Stimulation. However, that's not typical, or no one tells me about it. one talks about that. So,
but those contractions of those particular muscles are a part of the orgasmic release for males and females.
Right.
And so that stimulation at that time of contraction can be identified as an anal orgasm.
Yes.
But you've shifted now to talking about women's orgasms, and and we're running out of time. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest that maybe we should continue this conversation in our next podcast. And as we always do, we'd like to say that anybody that has any questions about these issues or others that they would like for us to discuss or respond to get in touch with you, and you can tell them how to do that.
Yes. If you have any questions or comments about our show or about bioidentical hormones and testosterone, please email them to podcast@biobalancehealth.com. We also invite you to visit our website at biobalancehealth.com and learn about our services, our supplements, and actually what we do about supplying testosterone to our patients. You can call my office, that's another option, 314-993-0963, or you can read my blog, drkathymaupin.com. It includes transcripts of this podcast as well as excerpts from the book that I'm writing. Thanks for listening. Thank you very much, Brett.
Thank you.
And I'm Dr. Kathy Maupin.